This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Thank you very much, Mr. Roger Mattish, for that news report this morning. And good morning to all of you across America, wherever our WGN signal is reaching this morning. Good to be back with you, as always, for our Saturday morning get-together. And we have a lot going on every week in the world of agriculture, but I want to lead today with a story that really came to play yesterday in our nation's capital. It prompted statements from Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue and also the chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee, Pat Roberts, who talked about this. Because here is the Secretary's statement. This is tremendous news for the American beef industry. He was talking about the return of American beef to the Chinese market, coming after a hiatus that began in 2004. But the agriculture community and the U.S. economy in general will see this as good news because, once again, we'll have access to the enormous Chinese market with a strong and growing middle class, which had been closed to our ranchers for a long, long time. I commend the persistence of the President, the Commerce Secretary, the Treasury Secretary, and U.S. Trade Representative, and our own USDA professionals. I also thank our Chinese counterparts who worked so hard to get this agreement into place. And the Secretary concluded by saying, when the Chinese people taste our high-quality U.S. beef, there is no doubt in my mind they'll want more of it. And then Senator Pat Roberts from Kansas, the chairman of the Senate Ag Committee, he said, I'm pleased to see the administration fully engaged in trade discussions that could have tremendous benefits for agriculture. There are several market access issues that need to be resolved with China, and progress on beef and biotechnology approvals would be beneficial for producers in Kansas and across the U.S. Negotiating market access for U.S. beef products into China has been a prolonged effort, and I will remain cautiously optimistic until I see the first shipment of American beef land in China. The words of Senator Pat Roberts, chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee. But finally, for the first time since 2004, we may get American beef into China, and it could be a huge market for American cattle producers. It's interesting, just a week ago on My Samuelson Says, I talked about the work that Clayton Yeider did when he was special trade representative and went to Tokyo back in the 80s to try to open up the Japanese market to American beef. I accompanied the trade representative. That was Clayton's job then. He later became Secretary of Agriculture. But I accompanied him as a media observer on that trip to Tokyo, and that was back in the mid-80s. And it was the beginning of the opening of the Japanese market to American beef, and ultimately Japan became our largest buyer of American beef foreign. So we start the morning show and conclude this week with some pretty good news indeed. Oh, and then the other thing, we have a new farm reporter in the field. Max Armstrong, of course, has been doing it for decades, but I received an email yesterday from our newest farm reporter. His name is Lyle Dean, who is a member of the Walk of Fame of WGN, and he and his wife, Judy, have a motorhome, and they spend a lot of time touring the country in the motorhome. So here's what he sent me late yesterday. Judy and I brought the motor home to the farm of a fellow RV couple, recreational vehicle couple near Carmi, Illinois. They are limited to one road access because of flooding. Floodwaters have come close to their farmstead, but so far only limited crop damage. Neighbors are not as lucky. We passed one set of farm buildings and home totally surrounded by a massive field of water. I'm attaching a couple of photos to try to show the magnitude of the flooding of the Wabash, the Little Wabash, and the Skittle Fork Rivers. Tens of thousands of acres involving miles and miles along I-64, all of it prime farmland. And indeed, the photographs showed nothing but water on land that is meant to grow corn and soybeans and other crops. So our new reporter, farm reporter, that's Mr. Lyle Dean. We're at 13 minutes after 5 o'clock here on the Saturday morning show. It's Mother's Day weekend. And so this year, I don't know how many years we've been doing it, but we will share with you the story of the American Farmer's Mom of the Year. And to get the direct report, let's turn to Max Armstrong, who probably knows how long we've been doing this. Max?
If I recall correctly, Orion, this is the eighth year that St. Louis-based Monsanto has sponsored the Farm Mom of the Year recognition program. And there were five finalists from around the United States. They came from Utah, Nebraska, Iowa, Mississippi, and Indiana. The individual nominated from Indiana was the one selected and announced yesterday as Farm Mom of the Year. Her name is Susan Brocksmith. She's from Vincennes, Indiana. That's down in Knox County along the Illinois-Indiana state line, about 250 miles south of Chicago. Susan Brocksmith is a farmer. She's also a university professor. And first and foremost, I'm sure she would list the fact that she is a mom. As I visited with her a couple of weeks ago, I asked her to tell me about that farm in Indiana.
Our home farm is just my husband and I for many years, and it's grown from when they started. My husband's family bought it with 230 acres, and now we have grown it to where it's at today. And it's been such a great tribute to our family and where we've been able to do what we've been able to do with it. We started and had to have animals, so we had a farrow to finish operation, had cattle, and over the years we've gotten out of that, and our most productive crop is our two children now.
And what are their ages?
My youngest daughter is 24 and my oldest daughter is 25. So
what are they doing with their lives?
My youngest daughter is getting ready to graduate with a master's in public health from St. Louis University, and my oldest daughter's in the third year of med school, hoping to get that MD next year.
You must be terribly proud of them.
Absolutely. We've been blessed. And the fun thing is we are on my husband's home farm. And my parents had a farm. My dad's passed last year, but they're only 20 minutes away. So I got to be home in a lot of ways.
What tasks do you handle and what do you enjoy most about it?
I like the ability to watch things grow and to know that nature and farmers get to do the things they like the best, to be outside and watch where things go, and the ability that my children got to be out on the farm. They could be dirty, but they also have that love for life and seeing how nature's circle works, that everything's going to grow, everything's going to pass away, but that love of life to come along with it, that's the best thing I've seen.
You teach.
I do teach. I teach at our local university, and I've been blessed to teach in the agribusiness world. And again, it's the things that are the most dear to me is to see these young students come in, and several of them haven't been away from home very much, and they come in, and over the 2 years, the growth that I see in both personally and professionally is just such a great thing for me. And the best thing is when they come back after that and they tell you, hey, I didn't realize what you taught me. And they come in and say, look what I've done with my life. And to watch them grow in their own lives is just a blessing.
I know you bring students to your farm. I met one who had been to your place. That must be part of the teaching process.
It is. I'm fortunate enough, our personal farm is closed, so I can go out there and tell the students, hey, meet me out at the farm. We're going to look at what cover crops do. We're going to go out there and collect weeds so you can have that hands-on, that see it, feel it, even smell some of them to help identify them. And that's where they really learn, when you get them in that environment. And every once in a while we'll have to get a little wet because it's dripping or something along those lines, but they can see that this is really being practiced. And it's not a book and you read it, that it's the real thing.
Finally, Susan, how do you look at your role in agriculture? I mean, in feeding the world, quote, to use the phrase that gets used so much, but how do you feel about what agriculture does to contribute to society and the fact that you're a part of it?
I am honored to be an advocate for ag. I think it takes all of us to make ensure everyone understands that we're not here just for us, but we're also here to make sure that we use all the resources of our earth for everyone, to take care of it, that it's in a better place than when we started, and that we have that piece of the world that we know that we can help people be healthier by making the right choices and doing good for everyone, and try to and send that message out that we're here for them.
It's a good feeling, isn't it, to be part of it?
It really is, and I don't know where else I could be in a better place but agriculture and have that impact on the earth.
Susan Brocksmith, Vincennes, Indiana. She's the Farm Mom of the Year, announced yesterday by Monsanto. Orion?
Well, thank you for that, and thank you for letting us get better acquainted with the new Farm Mom of the Year. She is one of five women who were recognized at the end of April as regional winners in the program. And all of them, including Becca Ferry of Utah, Sherry Sell Baker of Iowa, Kayla Tabb of Mississippi, and Nancy Kirkholm of Nebraska, along with Susan, were selected by a panel of American Agri-Women and Monsanto judges. And several inquiries wondering what the award winner receives and how you get into it. Well, Susan was nominated for the Farmer's Mom of the Year program by her daughters Victoria and Cassandra. And they noted in their application that Susan is a problem solver on the family farm, an advocate of agriculture in the community, and a role model for her daughters, and a professor who goes the extra mile for her students. Now, America voted online from April 28th through May 10th for one of the five regional winners to be named the national winner. All five women won $2,000 to direct to an eligible nonprofit organization of her choice in her community, as well as $3,000 for her personal use. Susan will receive another $2,000 to direct an eligible nonprofit for securing the most online votes to be named the National America's Farmers Mom of the Year. So congratulations. We'll be back with more when we continue on the Saturday Morning Show. It is 5:22 in the morning here on this Saturday, and it looks like maybe a pretty good weekend weather-wise across the Midwest to celebrate Mother's Day and also to get some more of that field work done. As long as we are saluting people this morning, let me take this opportunity to salute some people we have had on this program several times over the years, and a family that hosted about 50,000 visitors to their farming operation in 2009 for Wisconsin's Farm Technology Days. Here is the story. Crave Brothers, a family behind the award-winning Crave Brothers Farmstead Cheese and their business, just won the grand award for the Wisconsin Family Business of the Year in the medium-sized company category. Since 1980 now, the Crave family has lived and worked in the Waterloo, Wisconsin area And today, the Cray Brothers Farm and Cray Brothers Farmstead cheese business involves four brothers, Charles, Tom, Mark, George, and his wife, Debbie, Charles' daughter-in-law, Beth Crabe, three members of the younger generation, Jordan, Andrew, and Patrick, and then there's 86-year-old Bob Crabe, who contributes daily labor and who also provides expert woodworking skills. So, do want to congratulate them. They are truly a great family and symbolic of so many great agricultural production families in the country. They are active in local, county, state, national, and international agricultural communities, providing leadership, expertise, and financial support. Besides all of that, they make very good cheese. They have won state, national, and international cheese awards. And then, as I said, in 2009, hosted the Wisconsin Farm Technology Days. And most recently, Cray Brothers Farmstead Cheese earned two Best of Class awards in the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese Contest for fresh mozzarella and jalapeno cheddar cheese curds. So congratulations to the Crave family this morning up in Waterloo, Wisconsin, for putting together the entry that won them a class award in the state of Wisconsin. We'll be checking news. We'll be checking. Oh, we have a new market guest this morning making his first appearance here on the Saturday morning show. Every week we talk to market analysts around the Midwest to get their views on prices and trends and markets. And this morning, for the first time, we'll welcome John Zanker of J.C. Zanker in Lafayette, Indiana, to talk markets. Max will be chatting with him before we get to the 6 o'clock news. And speaking of news, we're coming up on the 5:30 news when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Thank you very much, Roger. And as we continue with the Saturday Morning Show, Max will talk markets with John Zanker of Lafayette, Indiana in a few minutes. But right now, we say welcome to Samuelson Says, sponsored by Wink Products Company, makers of the specialty quality cleaning products since 1947. On Samuelson Says this week, we look again at a continuing story on a California farmer fighting the U.S. government.
If you're frustrated by slow drains, or if you find yourself standing in water when you take a shower, the cause could be hair and soap scum buildup. Well, speed up your drains and solve your problem with Wink Hair Clog Blaster. Don't call the plumber. Pick up Wink Hair Clog Blaster instead. Wink Hair Clog Blaster, it does the job for you. Be sure to check out all the products offered by visiting their website at Wink. WHINK Wink.com.
John Duarte is a California farmer. We have talked about him several times on Samuelson Says, and over the past 2 or 3 years, he has been in a federal court over his disagreement with the Clean Water Act, which incidentally has now been put on hold because the minute that EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers talked about the Clean Water Act, farmers and farm groups across the country said, wait a minute, they wanted to take a pond that was dry half of the year and say it comes under the jurisdiction of the federal government and they can decide what to do with it. So anyway, let me tell you the story of John Duarte one more time. And as I say, we've interviewed him at Farm Bureau and on the phone over the years. But here's the story. He now faces up to $35 million in fines after a federal judge in March said she would not reconsider an earlier ruling rejected his claims that his work on the California wheat field is covered by a plowing exemption under the Clean Water Act. He farms near Modesto, California. He purchased the tract in 2012 and then plowed it to plant wheat. Well, the Army Corps of Engineers then sent Duarte a cease and desist order, alleging that he may have illegally gone through vernal pools on his property. What are vernal pools? Periodic wet areas that can provide wildlife habitat, but they're not wet the year around. And of the 450 acres that Duarte plowed, 22 acres contain vernal pools. So in response, Duarte sued, contending that his due process rights to a fair hearing had been violated. The government responded by countersuing. And in June of 2016, a federal judge in the Eastern District of California found that the Army Corps had not infringed on Duarte's property rights and that the cease and desist order did not constitute an enforcement action. Well, they continued in and out of court ever since. But now, because of a daily fine until he corrects the situation, there is $35 million facing John Duarte. That hardly seems the American way over 20 acres of land that he plowed. I wish him well. That's Samuelson Says, brought to you by Wink Products Company, a presentation of Tribune Radio Networks. Max Armstrong sits down to visit with John Zanker to talk markets when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show.
John Zanker joins us this weekend from J.C. Zanker. He's the president of the firm. Lafayette, Indiana is where he hangs his shingle. You watch very closely what's going on across the heartland of America this time of year. Let's talk about wheat to begin with. We've got numbers from USDA. We have numbers from the Kansas Wheat Tour. Is this whole picture still in motion? Do we have a ways to go yet before we know what has happened with the Kansas wheat crop?
I think we do, Max. We have obviously some problems in the Western Corn Belt. In the western wheat areas with a foot of snow in both Nebraska and Kansas in some areas. And our contacts in the area said it was pretty severe. It's tough to kill wheat. Everybody's aware of that. So I think in this instance, we're probably not giving it enough attention because of that. We've also had some extremely heavy rains in parts of Missouri, southern Illinois, southern Indiana, and Arkansas. And so I think we've probably done some damage to that crop as well.
The soft red winter wheat that is grown in those areas.
Exactly.
The wheat acreage, of course, is down substantially, especially in Kansas. It's down remarkably from a year ago. That makes this a little more interesting, I guess. But the world has been awash in wheat of late, and that takes a little bit of the sting out of it, I guess, as far as the millers are concerned.
Yes, we have a projected carryout right now for this marketing year of pushing $1.2 billion, and that's a little over 50% of a stocks to usage, and that's the largest number that we've seen in the past 30 years. So when you see that kind of stocks to usage ratio, nobody's showing a lot of concern at this point, and the world's awash in wheat. The funds are short 690 million bushels of soft red wheat on the board, and that's over twice the soft red production. So I think the speculators are comfortable with their position at this point, and losses from the last weekend's weather between the two crops are estimated to be 100 to 200 million bushels. And in the past, that would have been a pretty big deal. But at this point, that just means maybe we'll get this carryout down closer to 900 million after this crop's taken out.
As we look at the world and what is happening, former Soviet Union, the European Union, China, there are no problems there at the moment, are there?
We're not seeing any real big problems with wheat around the world. France has reduced their crop again, and their stocks are getting down to a fairly tight level. But as far as the major exporters, Russia has really come on. Their goal is to become the world's largest exporter of wheat. So they've been cranking out Ukraine, Argentina, China looks to be in line for a good crop. So at this point, not too many concerns around the world that's going to push wheat.
North of the border, of course, Canada is a significant wheat producer. They have yet to seed their crop, do they not?
There's a little bit of concern up there with their spring wheat planting. It's been trailing a little bit too, as ours was, but I think they're probably moving along now as well as we are in Minnesota and the Dakotas.
The market has been sending some signals, has it not, in terms of quality needs, the cash needs, in terms of looking for protein content. The feeling is that this hard red crop coming in out of the plains may not have the protein that the millers really want.
Yeah, our contacts out there, they're concerned about that. In fact, they're concerned about the quality of the carryover stocks as well. So where are we going to get the high-quality wheat to blend with the low-quality wheat to get that product to a level that the millers are really going to want, millers and exporters? So we have some problems developing, and what we need to keep in mind, though, is that a low-quality crop doesn't necessarily mean prices are going to go higher, but what we could see is some fairly aggressive bidding for high-quality wheat coming out of the field.
I thought I heard a report the other day, something to the extent that maybe the premium was up as much as a dollar for good quality high-protein wheat.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a lot of that. I think that's the story. If you're in the right place and you didn't get a foot of snow or 10 inches of rain, I think you'd be in a position to take advantage of some of those premiums.
There always seems to be a little bit of interest when the first combines start rolling and the first truckloads go across the scales. I would imagine that'll be watched with at least local interest this year, or certainly even if the globe isn't paying much attention to what's happening in hard wheat country.
Well, we had some, as you know, we had record yields last year, and pretty much we had record corn yield, record bean yields, record wheat yields. So we've kind of grown used to that all of a sudden. And I've been doing this for 30 some years. And about the time we get comfortable with something, it tends to change in a hurry. And you almost get the feeling that we're on the verge of something like that this growing season.
Well, that begs the question, have we gotten to the point where we will not have record corn yields for 2017?
I think we're there. And I think one of the keys is what's going on in Minnesota and Iowa. They're picking up the pace now with their planting after a slow start. Same thing with South Dakota, North Dakota, Wisconsin. But some of those fringe states that really pounded out some great yields last year, they're off to a slower start. They can still have a very good corn yield. Minnesota, a year ago on Sunday, was 87% planted, which is just an amazing number for the first weekend of May. And they went on to a record crop of 193 bushels per acre. They're about 2 weeks behind that this year. They're doing okay right now with their planting, and they're catching up. But I'm ready to cap that yield closer to the 14 record of 171.
Does this year feel like any other year that you've watched in your 30 years of doing this? I mean, you know, we tend to think of drought years. I guess those loom large in our minds. Many of us think of 83 and 88 and 2012 for sure. But would you be able to make an analogous comparison with 2017 with any other year that comes to mind?
Well, you threw out 83, and I remember that one like it was yesterday. I was a young merchandiser in Decatur, Illinois, and we fought a little bit of wetness in the spring, and our crops weren't in particularly good shape. We had shallow root systems, and then all of a sudden it turned hot and dry in the last week of June, and it didn't stop until the middle of August. So I would be a little concerned that we go into some heat this year without an established, without a root system that we would like. 95 might be similar. We struggled to get that crop in, and then we ran into some heat and dryness that year as well.
I remember 1983 was also the payment in kind year, was it not? Weren't we doing the pick thing back in 83?
Yes, we were. So we had some farmers setting aside 50 to 100% of their corn crop. So we got caught with a lot fewer acres than we thought we were going to have, and then the yield was just absolutely decimated.
Let's talk about the replanting that is taking place. For all of the
social media photographs we see and the video clips, and it's painful for a farmer to have to replant. It's expensive. It's a tough decision. It's a gut-wrenching thing to go into a field that you've planted and have to make that call about, okay, do we write this one off and go back in? There are a lot of considerations there, to be sure. How significant in the whole scheme of things in the United States corn crop is the replant that will be or is now taking place?
Well, my customers over the years have always said there's 2 to 3 days that they planted corn that they wish they didn't. And that doesn't necessarily mean they had to replant it, but it was just a case of the conditions not being ideal. And I have to think that for that corn that was planted 2 to 3 days ahead of this 8 to 10 inches of rain that we got over a fairly large portion of the corn belt, I would have to think that that corn's got some issues. And as I was driving up from Lafayette, Indiana yesterday evening, there's a lot of water standing in northwest Indiana, a little bit less in northeast Illinois. But I would say we'll get it replanted. We'll have the type of crop that can still yield pretty well. But again, I think it's just not off to that great start that we saw a year ago, which puts that 174.6 target in question.
I know a lot of growers, of course, have tiled. There's been a lot of tile that's gone into fields, as you know, over the past, 5 to 10 years. The yield monitor has sold a lot of field tile. And because of that, you don't sometimes see the water standing as long as it has a place to go. Obviously, if the ditch is full, that's a different story, by all means. But I guess one thing that comes to mind too is I wonder about the pollination period this year. When you have a more prolonged corn planting season, it should tend, should it not, to spread out the pollination and maybe make the crop a little less vulnerable if we turn off hot and dry in July.
Yes, that's certainly true, and I think we talk about that a lot. I think that the market in general is not terribly interested in trading too much water. Even in 1993 with the floods, they didn't get too excited about that until
we have rarely wiped out a crop by too much rain in the spring, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And so that makes it tough to get the market's interest in that sort of thing. But I think it does set up some problems. I'm a big believer in we make at least a third of that yield with good planting. And so that's a little bit questionable this year. We're just not off to we're off to the kind of start that could certainly give us 165 to 70 bushel crop. But that 174.6 record that we put in last year, that's going to be a tough one. And I think in the end, as it usually turns out, what happens in July with the heat and the dryness is going to be the biggest yield determinant.
Have we done any damage to the soybean yields yet?
I think it's a situation there again where we had 52.1 last year, which was just an incredible thing. Everything went pretty well, just almost perfect from start to finish. We had a little heat early on, but of course that doesn't typically bother the soybean plant. It might even help it. I think this year we're probably off to the kind of start where I wouldn't be comfortable predicting that kind of a yield. I think we could still do 50 bushel the acre, but I learned one thing I learned many years ago when my hair was quite a bit darker than it is today is if you try to predict a bean yield in May or June or even July, that soybean plant can make you look pretty silly.
John, the stocks to usage ratios, USDA tends to kind of overestimate those on soybeans, do they not? I mean, as the season goes on, when you compare May with August, hasn't that historically been the case?
It certainly was a year ago. We saw that the harvest issues down in Argentina, and that took a pretty good chunk out of their crop, and then some late dryness issues in Brazil as well. So we saw a sharp reduction in that carryout. As we move from, I think in March we had, and even April, we were well above 400 million and we ended up under 200 million.
But doesn't it tend to be the case quite often that USDA, especially on beans, I don't think it's as much the case on corn, is it?
It's been that way with beans because we, year on, just about every year in the last 10, we've been a little bit surprised about how aggressive the Chinese have been as far as importing. So I think we're seeing a little bit of that now, actually. Our export pace is in line to make the estimate. But the sales are 50 million bushels over right now, the total projected yearly sales. So I think the USDA is going to reveal that with probably a tighter carryout position. But as far as from this point forward, South America's had an incredible crop. And I don't think we're going to see the increase in exports from this point forward that maybe we have been seeing.
That South American crop is still much of it hanging out there, isn't it?
Well, Brazil's done for the most part. Argentina's still has some harvest going on, but
even with the marketing of it.
Oh no! Well, from the marketing, actually the Brazilians are Brazilian farmers being a pretty tight-fisted holder, which is somewhat unusual. So, with where the currencies are, where the prices are, he's been a little bit more tight-fisted, which is pushing some business our way. So, at some point, those beans will hit the market, and if those beans hit the market or start getting in our back pocket in, say, August, September, and if we have a real good yield, it's really going to add to the pain, I'm afraid.
Those supplies out there in the world, the wheat, the corn, the beans available to the market, it makes it hard for the market to get excited about weather in the spring, doesn't it? I mean, you just look at all of the rain dumped into the Corn Belt, and really it's been a pretty tepid response, has it not, in the futures?
Very tepid, and something that we would have definitely seen a bigger reaction from in the last few years when you were looking at a bean carryout under 200 million, and now you're looking at closer to 440, a corn carryout of 2.3, which is largest in 10 years. So we're just and we have a fund position of minus 900 million almost in corn, and they've certainly never ever taken that kind of a short into a growing season. They tend to like to be a little long. They don't want to miss out on that big drought market. So at some point, I still expect them to maybe move towards a long position, but they need a little bit more. They need a little more push here from the weather.
I suppose Wall Street makes it a little tougher for them to do so, to act in commodities too, doesn't it, as long as we continue to see the stock market performing the way it has been?
Yes, we certainly hear about money moving between markets. Commodities in general just haven't been very good. The CRB index is down.
Oil is pretty soft.
Absolutely. And I think the oil bulls have been trying to talk that market up for a while, but we keep underestimating U.S. production, and it keeps offsetting the OPEC cuts. And I'm not sure the OPEC and Russian cuts are quite as big as what we've been promised, so which is typically the case. But, you know, and if you look at the metals and copper, which is your biggest industrial metal, it's had a hard time here lately. And there's just not anything too exciting in the commodity world right now.
John, thanks for the time. It's good to talk to you.
It was great being here. Thank you, Max.
John Zanker. We'll look forward to having John back with us here on the Saturday Morning Show. Well, thank you very much for joining us for our weekly get-together on the Saturday Morning Show. Max Armstrong and I appreciate your company. We also appreciate the work of Bob Ferguson, who twirls the dials and turns the buttons here on the Saturday Morning Show. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. Oh, and if you're an Amazon Echo user, just say, play WGN Radio.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.